So I think we have a few minutes for questions, do we? 10 minutes for questions, and Jacqueline Asco, Professor Joe Stanford and myself could take any questions as well. So, yes. I'll share the mic. People online, you can ask questions as well. Raise your hand. There's a thing there. You can raise your hand and ask a question as well. So at the back. Sorry, for male infertility? Oh, I'd assess the tamoxifen. So the question is, how long do you stay on tamoxifen for male infertility? I usually leave 3 months. I say try your tamoxifen, repeat the semen analysis in 3 months, and if things have improved, stay on it. If things haven't improved, then drop it. So the question is, everybody aged 40 or over, or those with recurrent miscarriages, do I put everybody in alpha lipoic acid? I'm planning to, yes, because again, if it's the principle of primum non nocere, first do no harm, and you can just take this if you want to prevent aging. It has anti-cancer prevention effects as well. So there are good reasons anyway to take this type of a supplement, and I suspect it can improve both sperm and egg quality to make you more likely to conceive and less likely to miscarry. So yes, I'm recommending that. I will be recommending it to everybody, so the practitioners can feel free to recommend it. The DHEA, I don't give it for polycystic ovaries, but if they don't have polycystic ovaries, then yes, there seems to be a suggestion that there may be benefit from that as well. Yes, Heather.
You were saying for male factor infertility, you always try to optimise the women's fertility as well. I assume that is the reverse applies as well. So if there's female factor infertility, you're always doing your best to optimise male fertility too, and men coming in get put on standard treatment.
For men, so the question is that we do we optimise both male and female fertility for couples that are coming for fertility treatment? And the answer is yes. So we assess the male and we assess the female. And if traditionally what I used to do is if the male was normal, then say if there was recurrent miscarriages or the semen analysis was found to be normal, then we're done evaluating the guy. But because of this question of the DNA fragmentation, that there is room that we may not have done everything possible for the fellow. So the whole idea for both of them is get them both healthy and both happy. So the healthy lifestyle, no smokes, no alcohol, no caffeine, no stress, supplements for up to 6 months. And so that applies to everybody, yes.
Just a question about the postnatal depression. You said you treat with IM progesterone. Can you treat other types of depression with IM progesterone? Or has that ever been shown in the literature?
So the question is, for postnatal depression, we treat it with intramuscular progesterone, and can progesterone help ordinary depression? And we haven't looked at that yet. So unless Professor Stanford knows better, but as far as I know, we've only given it for the postnatal depression scenario.
In the premenstrual syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Depression.
Premenstrual syndrome.
Premenstrual syndrome, in fact, instead of Prozac, you saw the effectiveness of giving progesterone for premenstrual syndrome in the luteal phase progesterone. But apart from that, it's important if you do treat it for depression, you give it cooperatively. Which means you only give it in the luteal phase when it should be there, and if you work with your chart and give it in a timed fashion, then it'll work. Otherwise, it makes premenstrual syndrome much worse. Moyad.
The question is surgical. Of when do you decide this patient needs surgical investigation? Because I know there are certain centers, they use the x-rays and tubal defensive, and that is may not be the whole problem, because as we all know, and from my simple understanding, therapy technology and infertility is there is a huge lot of immune reaction inside the body, and patent tube or patent road may not be safe route.
Yes, yeah, so the question from Oyad was, when do we recommend surgical intervention, and do we rely just on assessment of tubal patency by HSG or HICOSI, or do we think, how important do we rate surgery? And surgery is really important, but equally important, it depends on who does it. And frustratingly for us, we have found a huge variation in standards of the surgeons, and we need surgeons who have this the NAPRO technology type of surgery, where they use near-contact laparoscopy, where they are very meticulous in the assessment and treatment of all little deposits of endometriosis. So we're just very particular about who does the surgery for us. The big question is to decide, when do they need to go for surgery? My take, being a family physician perspective, is stay away from the surgeon if you can. But if you need them, go quickly. And so that if we feel that surgical intervention isn't needed, don't go for unnecessary surgery. The challenge is sometimes it becomes very clear, very obvious symptoms to suggest endometriosis or obvious things from the ultrasound. But if we don't have success at our halfway mark of 6 effective cycles, even if you're totally symptom-free with a completely normal ultrasound and previous patent tubes, at that point I recommend surgical intervention for everybody. And more than a few times, we've been significantly surprised by the extent of surgical problems. I've seen severe grade 4 endometriosis with no symptoms and completely and patent tubes completely missed by history and examination. And so it's really, I think, the surgical evaluation is critical.
I can comment on that.
Just the right one. And,
so on the... the data, I didn't show this because we haven't published it yet, but on the data from Phil's practice with the Irish study, we looked at different predictors of outcomes, and one of the things we looked at is just whether they had had a laparoscopy, not what they found, but just whether they had one. Now, this isn't randomized or anything in people's, but anybody that had a laparoscopy was 1.9 times more likely to have had a live birth. Just having had a laparoscopy. So I've actually transitioned more to pushing people to laparoscopy earlier. So I say, as soon as you're ready to go, let's not wait. If they're reluctant and they don't have any symptoms of endometriosis other than the infertility, and they want to try for a while without surgery, that's fine. But I tend to push them as to somebody who does a good NAPRO evaluation surgery, not to anybody. I've been quite disappointed sometimes with some gynecologist surgeries, but people I know that do a good job, I like to get them there as soon as they're willing to go.
And just finally, to support that point as well, Dr. Hilgers in the United States does a laparoscopy for everybody on cycle 3, so everybody gets the lap quickly.
I'll just explain the reason why I ask the question is basically one-third of the patients who go for fertility treatment from the reported literature, about 30% will have endometriosis problems. And if we look at the Cochrane database, I think there was a published Cochrane study around 2009-2010 showing that even if you just with the simple mild endometriosis, if you diathermy these, then your fertility chances will quickly. So it's quite important to tackle this problem at the stage.
I emphasize that that's true. There's a good Cochrane review of randomized trials showing that fertility increases dramatically. Next question online. It increases dramatically with, dramatically with endometriosis, even mild and moderate, that it was treated. The IVF doctors discount it. They say, well, still not the rate. You're still not getting pregnancy rates that are per cycle. Per cycle, they always think per cycle instead of over time. They say per cycle, they're still not that great, and so we can do better with IVF, so why do it? But if you're looking at somebody going out 6 cycles, 8 cycles, it's very good rates. And I definitely agree. And that's something you can point people to, even though it's really amazing they just discount it. But it is part of the Cochrane and randomized trials supporting endometriosis therapy. Absolutely.
So who's the online question for?
Zora Slava has a question, and I'm not sure who it's for. I think anyone could speak to it. Are there some other treatment options than low-dose corticosteroids for late-onset congenital adrenal hyperplasia?
What's the question again?
Late onset congenital or
I think that's for Joe.
No. I think we need Maria Carrad here to answer that. She's our, we have her speak at a number of our meetings. She's a great endocrinologist and does a lot of work with us. Congenital adrenal hyperplasia, I think we're going to have to defer that question, have her correspond directly with Maria Carrad for that one.
I think we could also include that in our webinar series.
Yeah, we could do a webinar on that. That's a good idea. We have a webinar series that goes on every month, and we could add that to that list, yeah.
Dr. Maloney.
Just getting back to the diagnosis of unexplained infertility, I mean, I think all that you said in relation to endometriosis is absolutely right. I think I'm a gynecologist by training and do a lot of laparoscopy. And I think the important thing in making your diagnosis is you cannot make a diagnosis of unexplained infertility until you've done a laparoscopy. One of the best studies, I think, which goes back a quite a long way, is the Endocan study, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which looked at 960 couples nice. With unexplained infertility with absolutely no symptoms at all.
Right.
And in those 960, all of whom had a laparoscopy, 340 had stage 1 or stage 2 endometriosis.
Right.
And when that was treated in a randomized fashion, there was 50% more pregnancies in the treated than the non-treated group. Right. So I think endometriosis low-grade is impossible to diagnose by anything other than laparoscopy.
Brilliant, yes. So did everybody hear that? Just the comment from Dr. Maloney is that the importance, again, of laparoscopy and that symptoms alone will not help you to diagnose it. The only way you know for sure is you do your laparoscopy and treating it is worthwhile and you get higher pregnancy rates with that. Summary. Thank you. So the question is, with male factor infertility, if tamoxifen doesn't work and we're trying to improve the semen analysis, how long do we go with HCG injections for? And it's really if they have hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism, for a mouthful. So if their endocrine parameters are low for their FSH and LH, that they're more likely to respond to HCG, and often we would give Menopure as well. So, and we've had it's not a very common diagnosis at all. It's listed as one of these things that's worth treating on the NICE fertility guidelines, but the number of people with that diagnosis is low. And the length of time that you go for any intervention, from intervention to impact, they say it takes 72 days. So we typically allow about 12 weeks to assess any impact of treatment. And if a treatment is working, we would usually continue it, hopefully, until the couple conceive. But I think that's us. We've got one final question, and then we'll break for coffee and biscuit, I think, hopefully.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, thank you, Shirley. It's Lucy Smith calling in from Melbourne, Australia.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Regarding the premature ovarian failure, do you tend to have an upper limit for your FSH in terms of going ahead with the protocol you outlined?
Thank you. So the upper limit of FSH... The highest that we had somebody achieve a successful pregnancy with treatment was an FSH of 37. And we had somebody with an FSH of 34, 27, 25. So, but recently we had somebody coming to our practice and she had an FSH of 67. And we did everything we could, maximum doses of treatment, and for 3 months in a row failed to achieve any ovulation induction at all. By ultrasound, her ovaries were completely unresponsive, so she quit. She was aged 42 to 43, and she quit, and I think it was 3 months later, she came back with a positive pregnancy test, and she was 10 weeks pregnant with no intervention at all. So it's the classic thing where you never say never, but I would think that above 40 we're unlikely to get an ovarian response, but I'd be prepared to try that treatment strategy for any kind of an FSH level and say, well, let's see how it goes. And the most recent thing that we're quite excited about is looking at AMH levels. And we have a couple recently pregnant where her AMH was 1, and she wasn't suitable to go for IVF because she wouldn't produce enough eggs to make IVF worthwhile. And we applied that, and the AMH is more sensitive. Her FSH was still normal, but we applied our usual treatment, and she's currently pregnant. So I'd be cautious above 40, I would think, but I would be a little tenacious and have a little bit of an attitude of never say never. And if you try the treatment, then you'll know if they respond or not. Thank you for that question. So we'll take a break and we'll be back at 12 o'clock for Professor Farr Curlin.